You'd open your Bibles to Hebrews 13. We are continuing our study. I'm trying to work it out so that I get to verse 20 for Easter Sunday, because that's a great verse on the resurrection, and I think I can do it here. But this morning we are in verses 5 and 6. And so if you would open there, there's an outline on the back of the bulletin. There's a few extras at both entrances too. We're trying to put the outlines out separate too from the bulletin. So if you want to grab more than one outline, you can. And there are printed and tape and CD messages available afterward as well. Just two verses this morning. Hebrews chapter 13, verse 5 and verse 6. Make sure that your character is free from the love of money, being content with what you have. For he himself has said, I will never forsake or desert you, nor will I ever forsake you. So that we confidently say, the Lord is my helper, I will not be afraid. What will man do to me? A Jewish man in Hungary went to his rabbi and complained about his difficult living situation. He said, life is unbearable. There are nine of us in a one-room shack. He said, what can I do? The rabbi said, take your goat into the house with you. The man was incredulous, but the rabbi persisted. He said, do as I say and come back and see me in a week. A week later, the man came back and he was more distraught than he had been the week before. He said, this is terrible. He said, this goat is filthy, dirty. It's crowded in there. The rabbi said, go home and let the goat out and come back and see me in a week. The man went home and let the goat out, came back in a week, and he was beaming. He said, life is wonderful now. He said, it's just the nine of us in the house, no goat. Well, I think that story shows that contentment is more than our circumstances. It's how we view our circumstances. Our perspective has a lot to do with contentment. But even among God's people, true contentment is not always a common thing. Even the Puritan Jeremiah Burroughs, I think, saw that when he wrote a book called The Rare Jewel of Christian Contentment. Immanuel Kant, the philosopher, saw this when he observed, give a man everything he wants, and at that moment, everything will not be everything. In other words, we're still going to want more because we seem to lack contentment. Now, even though it's rare, contentment isn't just optional for Christians. I think the implication in the context of our text is that the participle here, being content, has a command force to it. It is an exhortation saying that's how we are supposed to be, because as you think about it, we cannot glorify God if we're not content. Each of us is an advertisement for God, and if we're going around glum and downcast and grumbling, it doesn't exactly make people want to line up and say, could I meet this God that you're following? You know, I'd really like to be like you are. And so contentment is vital for our testimony, to give glory and praise to God. As you know, Israel in the wilderness sinned by being discontent. God had just done mighty miracles, moved them out of Egypt, was providing for them there in the wilderness with the pillar of cloud by day to cover them and the pillar of fire by night to warm them and light their way. And they grumbled and complained and wanted to go back to Egypt. Now, the exhortation of our text may stem from back in chapter 10 and verse 34. The author there had said that in the former days, you joyfully accepted the seizure of your property, knowing that you have for yourselves a better possession and a lasting one. But now they had need of endurance. And so maybe some of them, after their property had been confiscated unlawfully, had begun to grow anxious, and they thought, you know, we got to get our property back. And so now their focus was on that. And as you know, there is a fine line between seeking after material things and loving them. And in verse 1, he had said, let love of the brethren continue. And in verse 5, he says, make sure you're free from the love of money, because you cannot love the brethren and love money at the same time. Those are opposite. And of course, Jesus said you can't love God if you love money. So the author here is exhorting them and us to cultivate this rare but essential jewel of Christian contentment. And he shows that contentment is cultivated by pulling the weeds of greed and building your life on God and on His promises. The first thing to note here is that contentment has to be cultivated. Any of you have a spontaneous garden at your home? Just sprung up with beautiful flowers all nicely arranged? Of course not. You have a garden, it's because you cultivated it. You deliberately planned it out and you worked and you pulled the weeds and watered it and all of that stuff, and you have a garden. Same thing with contentment. The Apostle Paul wrote from prison in Philippians 4:11. He said, I've learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. And if the Apostle Paul had to learn contentment, then guess what? So do we. It doesn't happen spontaneously. Now, what is it? Well, to cite Jeremiah Burroughs again in his book, he defines it as that sweet, inward, quiet, gracious frame of spirit which freely submits to and delights in God's wise and fatherly disposal in every condition. Or to quote another Puritan, John Owen, he wrote that contentment is a gracious frame or disposition of mind, quiet and composed, without, number one, complaining at God's providential disposals of our outward concerns. Secondly, without all envy at the more prosperous condition of others. Thirdly, without fears and anxious cares about the future supplies. And fourthly, without desires and designs of those things which a more plentiful condition than what we are in would supply us with. Now, to develop contentment, we have to realize that the world is always seeking to make us feel discontent. That's the purpose of advertising. Ads, whether it's TV or magazines or newspapers or catalogs, whatever, they're trying to make you think, I cannot be happy till I buy this. I need this product. And so we're getting bombarded with this stuff. A PBS TV special estimated that the average American views 1 million commercials by the time you hit 20. I did the math on that, and starting at day zero, you know, and going, that's 137 commercials a day for 20 years. And even if they're overstating it, as many commercials as bombard us cannot have just a neutral effect on us. And so we have got to fight the influence of the world, or its swift current is just going to carry us downstream with it. Now, before we go any further, I want to answer a couple of questions that our text automatically prompts in our minds. One is it wrong to seek to better our circumstances through hard work and better income? Or to ask it in the opposite way, is this text saying just be unconcerned about material things and about your financial condition and drift through life without any ambition or just living from hand to mouth, no desire to get ahead? Well, as you come to the questions, you have to balance truth, as often in Scripture, by holding seemingly opposite things in tension. And if you go too far one way or too far the other way, you get out of balance. On the one hand, the Bible condemns laziness and it commends hard work to provide for our own and our family's needs. The book of Proverbs, it's a frequent theme there. Or in the New Testament, the Apostle Paul stated very strongly in 1 Timothy 5:8, he said, but if anyone does not provide for his own family, or his own, and especially for those of his household, he is denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. That's a pretty strong statement. The Apostle Paul reminded the Thessalonians of his own example and how when he was with them, he says, I didn't eat anyone's bread without paying for it. And he, both by example and command, taught them to work hard and provide for their needs. And in verse 10 of 2 Thessalonians 3, he said, if anyone isn't willing to work, then he is not to eat either. Fairly strict rule. Don't work, don't eat. The Bible also commends wealth as a sign of God's blessing, and it commands us to manage the resources that God entrusts to us carefully. It tells us to have the foresight and the discipline to say there's a future need out here, and if I'm going to meet that need, I must save and plan for it, and so on. All of those things are commended in the Bible. On the other side, we have to hold in tension the fact that the Bible warns us about the dangers of wealth. Jesus, I think, shocked the disciples in Matthew 19:23 when he said, truly, I say to you, it is hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. In a similar way, the Apostle Paul warned in 1 Timothy 6, 9 and 10. He said, those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires, which plunge men into ruin and destruction. Then he added, for the love of money is the root of all sorts of evils, and some by longing for it have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. So as you hold these truths in tension, the important thing is your heart motive on why do I need more? Is it legitimately to provide for the needs of my family and myself or some future anticipated need, saving up for an automobile or a home or whatever? Those can be legitimate needs. To want to have more so that you can give more. You hear about young people going out into missions and you say, Lord, I would like to have more money to support that person. That's a biblical right motive for wanting more. But on the other hand, if you drift into trusting in your money rather than in the Lord, you're going the wrong way. Or if you're storing up treasures on earth rather than in heaven, Jesus said you'll lose it all. Or if you live in abundance but you don't have concern for the poor, then according to Ezekiel 16:49, you're committing the sin of Sodom. That's what was the case of Sodom. They had plenty, but they had no concern for the poor. Or if you're seeking contentment out of your money or your things rather than God himself, then again, you'll come up empty. So be very careful, because it's easy to be deceived by the world's bombardment saying you aren't content until you have fill in the blank. A second thing to note here is that contentment doesn't grow without cultivation and maintenance. You may be content in the Lord today, and tomorrow you're tempted. It's that way. Contentment and greed are both attitudes in your mind, and the enemy is always trying to plant seeds to get you discontent so you'll go in the wrong direction. And so you have to cultivate contentment. You have to guard your thought life, and you have to develop a biblical view of possessions and of eternity. You have to avoid comparing yourself with others, realizing God is sovereign and he gives to some much, to others less. And maybe if he gave more to me, I would be tempted and it would ruin me and my faith. And God knows how much to entrust to me so that I can be a faithful steward. I think to develop contentment, the main thing is to bow daily before God's sovereignty and let him provide for all of your needs. Psalm 23 is a psalm of a contented sheep. I think I preached a sermon on it here once. Contentment. And you might meditate on that psalm often as it applies to you under the hand of the Good Shepherd. But our text recognizes that this garden of contentment doesn't grow weed-free. And so to cultivate contentment, you have to constantly pull these weeds of greed. He says, make sure that your character or your way of life is free from the love of money. Now, you notice in verse 4 that we looked at last week, it talks about sexual immorality. Verse 5 talks about greed. That is a common link in the New Testament. And I, for sake of time, won't go there. But there's 5, 6, 7 passages in the New Testament that link those. And the Bible presents greed as a terrible sin equal to idolatry. We tend as Americans not to confess this sin. I think Spurgeon said he rarely had a man come to him and confess he was greedy in all of his ministry. I can't think of anybody ever confessing that sin to me, but it ruined Balaam. It ruined Achan. It ruined Elisha's servant Gehazi. The rich young ruler was kept out of heaven because of his greed. Judas Iscariot, Ananias and Sapphira, and Felix, who was looking for a bribe from Paul, and therefore he wouldn't listen really to the message of the gospel. Jesus, in the parable of the soil, the parable of the sower, he mentions worries and riches and the pleasures of this life as the thorns that can grow up and choke out the word so that it doesn't bear fruit in one's life. And in Luke chapter 12, verse 15, Jesus gave a very direct warning. He said, "Beware and be on your guard against every form of greed. For even when a man has an abundance, not even when one has an abundance, does his life consist of his possessions." And he went on from there to tell the parable of the rich fool who was thinking, "Hey, let's build bigger barns and hold more stuff." And God said, "You fool, tonight your soul is required of you." And then Jesus concluded in Luke 12:21 and said, "So is the man who stores up treasures for himself and is not rich toward God." So this greed or the love of money is this weed that keeps popping up in our garden, and we got to keep yanking it if we want to be content. And you can pull it one day and the next day there it comes up again. You got to get out there and yank it up again. So let me just share with you four ways that you can keep this weed of greed from taking over. First of all, to pull the weeds of greed, you have to acknowledge God's ownership of all that you are and have. "The earth is the Lord's," Psalm 24:1 declares, "and all it contains." It's not mine. It's not yours. It's the Lord's. Or as Paul put it in asking a rhetorical question in 1 Corinthians 6:19 and 20, he said, "Don't you know that you are not your own, for you have been bought with a price?" And as you know, Jesus frequently used parables where God is the owner and we are the stewards or managers. And he's entrusted a certain amount to each one and said, "Use this until I return for my purposes." And the steward would invest it or not and then be called to account. And that's a picture of, again, what God has entrusted to us. We don't own the store. God does. And God gives us a little bit and says, "Use it for my purpose and kingdom." Now, of course, he grants us to draw a reasonable salary as a manager. But to take it all and squander it on myself and say, "Oh, yeah, here, Lord," not being a good steward, a good manager. A good manager is always thinking of the master's purposes. Why did he give this to me? What does he want me to do with it? And how to then use it for him. Now, if you get this perspective on your things and your money, it frees you from a lot of anxiety. For example, if you've ever, as I have, lost a chunk of money or had someone ding up a new car, it's nice to be able to say, "Lord, they just took your money." Or, "Lord, they just banged up your car while I was parked at Safeway getting groceries, and they didn't even bother to leave a note. And your car, Lord, has a dent now on the side of it. You know, it still grieves you, but at least it's not my car. It's the Lord's car." And so acknowledge God's ownership of everything. Secondly, to pull the weeds of greed, put your treasure where you want your heart to be. Jesus said very plainly, Matthew 6:21, "For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." You notice the order. We would say it the other way. Where your heart is, that's where you'll put your treasure. Jesus said, no, your heart follows your treasure. You've experienced this principle perhaps if you've ever invested in a stock. Let's say, for sake of example, somebody says, you know, AT&T is a good investment, and so you put your savings into AT&T, and you pick up tomorrow's paper, and on the front page it says some giant communication conglomerate just bought out AT&T. Do you turn the page and say, ho-hum, I wonder what else is news? No. See, your treasure is there with AT&T, and so your heart is in it, so you read that article with a fine-tooth comb and maybe go get the Wall Street Journal at the library and read it and call your broker and say, what's going on here with AT&T? Your heart follows your treasure into AT&T. Do you want your heart in God's things, in the things of God? Invest in God's work. It works. Have you ever supported a missionary somewhere, maybe in China, and you open the paper and you read China crackdown on religious groups? Wow. You read that thing carefully and begin to pray for your friend because you've invested in them. Your heart followed your treasure into China. And it works that way. It's the way God made it. A third way to pull the weeds of greed is to live in the light of eternity. You know, greed is always short-sighted. It focuses on this life only and not on eternity. Because what good is money if I'm checking out? You know, say a man is on his deathbed. The doctor has said, you're terminal. He's got cancer. He's still conscious, but he's not going to live. And Bill Gates comes up and says, I'll give you $1 billion. Unless he wants it for his heirs, what good is it for him? None. He can't use it. Why? He's leaving. He's checking out. You know, death is not a pretty good chance. It's a certainty. It's a 100%er for us. Unless Jesus returns, we're all going that way. And we ought to live in light of a certainty in the way we invest. I heard about two people discussing the death of a recent wealthy man. And one said, how much did he leave? And the other one said, all of it. It's how much we all leave, isn't it? As they say, you never see a hearse pulling a U-Haul. I got a cartoon on my bulletin board out here by the in the hallway where Frank and Ernest are at the pearly gates, and he's got all his junk with him. And he said, at least I thought there'd be lockers. You know, there are no lockers in heaven. We leave it all behind. But you can't take it with you, but you can do this. You can send it on ahead. You can invest in the bank of heaven, and it's laid up there, and it's secure for all time and eternity. Jesus made that point when he told the story about the unjust steward in Luke chapter 16. It confuses people because they think, is Jesus commending this guy that's dishonest? No, he's not. But here's the point of that story. The guy is going to get fired. And he knows he's going to get fired, so he's looking to his future, and he calls in all his master's creditors and adjusts the books downward so that they get off light. What he's doing is he's making friends for his future with what he's got in hand right now. And then Jesus applies that in Luke 16:9. He says to you, I say to you, make friends for yourselves by means of the wealth of unrighteousness, so that when it fails, they will receive you into eternal dwellings. He didn't say if it fails. He said when. It will fail. Money will fail you, but you've got it in hand right now. And if you're smart, Jesus is saying, you'll use it to lay up for your future by making friends for eternity. And you see, if you invest in the cause of world mission, when you get to heaven, there are going to be people from all over the place coming up saying, thank you. You gave, and I'm in heaven because you gave and that missionary came and told me the gospel. Thank you. And you got a friend for eternity in heaven. What better investment is there than that? It won't fail. The final way to pull these weeds of greed is to make it your aim to give more, not to get or accumulate more. You know, giving is God's antidote for this poison of greed. Just give. Give. Let it go. Now, when we get more, we're all tempted. I'm tempted. You're tempted. We all are to say, oh, good. Now I can get fill in the blank. before you do that, and that's not always wrong, by the way, sometimes God gives us more, just as I would to my children, so they could get something they needed or wanted, and that's legitimate. But God may be sending you more because he wants you to be the channel to give more to his cause. And so stop when you get more and say, Lord, how do you want me to distribute this? How do you want it to be used? Now, for years, I have taught, and I still believe, tithing is not God's standard for New Testament giving. That sounds radical coming from a pastor, but it's not. God's standard is, as he has prospered you, and if you want to use 10% as a starting low point, fine, start there. But don't stay there, because we've all prospered so much, you can afford to give a lot more than 10%. And remember, God owns it all. In an appeal to giving in 2 Corinthians 9, the Apostle Paul wrote, "And God is able to make all grace abound to you, so that always having all sufficiency in everything, you may have an abundance for every new toy." Is that what it says? Every good deed. See, God doesn't just give us an abundance so we can go, oh, good, I can get this and this and this and this and this and, you know, maybe 10% to the Lord. He gives us an abundance so we can give. My life was changed in the summer of 1970 when I read for the first time George Mueller of Bristol. I think we have some new copies of it out on the book table, unless the first service grabbed them. It's a steal, $3. For the autobiography of George Mueller. And if that book won't change your life, I don't know what will. But Mueller was supported because he gave away everything he owned, he and his wife. And they said, Lord, provide for us so that we can provide for these orphans. And they started an orphanage. And pretty soon they were supporting 2,000 orphans full time, making their needs known only to God, not to any donors, until after the fact, they would publish how God had worked. And at one time, Mueller, who was being supported by whatever gifts came in for his own support, was personally supporting fully all 33 missionaries with the China Inland Mission. All of them. He was supporting them full time with his income. See, he could have been living lavishly, saying, oh, praise the Lord, he's given me more. I can get a better house, better this, better that. Instead, he gave and he gave and he gave. One year, which was fairly typical, 1874, I did the math. Mueller lived on 8% and gave away 92%. So if you want a tithe, there's a tithe. Live on 10, give away 90. That's what happened with Mueller. And God always met this man's needs. And his reading his autobiography or biography is just a story of God answering prayer. And here's a man who lived simply, could have lived lavishly, but instead refused to accumulate, just gave, gave, gave. And God blessed George Mueller as he has few men. So contentment then has to be cultivated. It comes by constantly pulling these weeds of greed, but the author gives us some motivation. The motivation, contentment, he says, comes by building your life on God and God's promises. He says, for he himself has said, I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you, so that we may confidently say, the Lord is my helper, I will not be afraid. What will man do to me? Now that first quote, I will never desert you or ever forsake you, is not found in verbatim in the original text in the Old Testament, but there are about 5 or 6 texts that are very similar. So I think what the author's doing is kind of grabbing them all together and just giving a paraphrase, but certainly the truth is there. The Lord won't forsake you. The second promise comes from Psalm 118, verse 6. And I think Spurgeon had 4 or 5 sermons on just that first promise, so I could easily do a bunch of sermons here, but I'm just going to briefly try to apply this. First of all, notice that contentment comes from building your life on God himself, not on what you want God to give you. You know the difference? A lot of Christians use God to get what self wants. That's not knowing God. We submit to God, and God, of course, meets our needs. But if you are using God, saying, give me this, give me that, give me this, you'll never be satisfied, because you can't be satisfied with things. You can only be satisfied with God. The Bible is clear on that. Israel in the wilderness craved for meat. God gave them meat, but it says he sent leanness into their soul. Rachel craved children. Give me sons or I die. Well, she got sons, but she died, because she died in childbirth. By way of contrast, in Psalm 73, the psalmist begins the psalm by saying, I almost stumbled because I was envious of the wicked. And then the psalmist, in the middle of the psalm, goes into the sanctuary of God. He gets his perspective right on eternity. He realizes God is going to judge the wicked, but he's going to take me to be with him in heaven. And then in the end of the psalm, verses 25 and 26, he makes this tremendous statement. Whom have I in heaven but you? Now, can you say this next part with him? And besides you, I desire nothing on earth. That's quite a statement. Besides you, God, nothing on earth. God alone satisfies the soul. He continues, my flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. And David knew the same thing. In Psalm 63, he's running for his life. He's in the Judean wilderness, not exactly comfy, cozy conditions. And because he had sought the Lord, he writes in verse 5, my soul is satisfied. You want a satisfied soul? Out in the wilderness, people trying to kill you, seek God. Seek God. He says, my soul is satisfied as with marrow, and fatness in my mouth offers praises with joyful lips. Not only does contentment come from building your life on God, but also on God's certain promises. The author says he himself has promised. See, these promises aren't the words of some man. They're the words of the living God who spoke the universe into existence, the God whose word never fails. He has promised, and he mentions two of them. First, he says, build your life on God's promise never to desert you or forsake you. Verse 5 is a good place where knowing some Greek helps, because the Greek text piles up five negatives here, one on top of the other, on top of the other, to say, I will never, 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 never leave you. I mean, you get the point? You know, he's just driving it home. I think the best English is the last verse of our hymn, How Firm a Foundation, where the author says, the soul that on Jesus hath leaned for repose, I will not, there's one, I will not, there's two, desert to its foes. That soul, though all hell should endeavor to shake, I'll never, there's three, no, never, there's four, no, never, forsake. He got it right out of this text. That's where that comes from. And God hammers home the assurance here. There is no circumstance or no time or no place where you can be where God will abandon you if you are his child. What a great promise. Now, you got to think that through. You could be in a dungeon. You could be in prison being beaten for your faith, or even executed. He's there. He's there with you. He's promised. And he'll use that to take you to be with him in glory forever and ever, never to be separated from him. And that reality enables us then to be content, because our money, our health, our loved ones, they can take all that, even our lives. Can't take God. God is with us. And then the second promise, build your life on God's promise to be your helper, so that we confidently say, the Lord is my helper. I will not be afraid. What will man do to me? It comes from Psalm 118, verse 6. Well, what can man do to you? Well, they can take your property. They can torture you. They can kill you or your loved ones. But again, the author is saying, God is my helper. And if I have riches in heaven with him, then everything's secure. And so I can be content. Martin Luther knew that in his great hymn, A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. He wrote, the body they may kill. God's truth abideth still. His kingdom is forever. Our former Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, observed, to Americans, usually tragedy is wanting something very badly and not getting it. Many people have had to learn in their private lives, and nations have had to learn in their historical experience, that perhaps the worst form of tragedy is wanting something badly, getting it, and finding it empty. So where do you begin to cultivate the contentment that will never disappoint? Well, you have to start in the right place. As A.W. Tozer said, the man who has God for his treasure has all things in one. I read about a Puritan who sat down to a meager meal of bread and some water, and he exclaimed, what? All this and Jesus Christ too? He had the right perspective. George Mueller again used to say, the first business of every day is to be truly at rest and happy in God. Happy in God. If you begin there, you will begin to cultivate contentment, and then just make sure you yank out those weeds of greed that pop up day to day. Dear Father, I pray you would help us as your people to glorify your name by being content in Jesus Christ and in him alone. I pray if any are here who do not enjoy forgiveness of sin, they would realize that they do not earn that. They cannot merit it. It is your free gift because your Son paid the penalty for all who will come to the cross and trust in his shed blood. And I pray that everyone here would have the assurance of sins forgiven and of heaven as a sure thing, not because of themselves, but because of your free gift in Christ. Free us from the love of money. Make us content with what you've given us. Help us to be good stewards of all you've entrusted to us as we lay up treasures for soon coming eternity will be upon us very shortly. And only what we do for you during this short time on earth will last for eternity. And so we ask you, Lord, to give us your perspective this week as we manage what you've given us for Jesus' sake. Amen.